Mr. Roseman, thank you very much for coming in.
My
name's Chris Seifer, and I'll give you the opening spiel we give to everybody. We're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Our job is to figure out the causes of the financial crisis in a 1 year's time, no less. And the statute that created us was the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009. That was passed in May of last year. That statute tells us to do a lot of things in terms of trying to figure out the causes, and several things it does is tell us to look at the role of derivatives, tells us to look at the role of securitizations, etc. Tells us to look at every financial institution that failed or would have failed, but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance. So we are currently looking at, amongst other things, derivatives, securitizations, some institutions that issued securities that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance. And the reason we contacted, I guess, you and ACA previously was to look at some of these CDO practices. We have contacted and talked to and requested documents from several issuers, several CDO managers, several investors, so please don't feel singled out. You're one of many that we're talking to. And I haven't had a chance to look at everything, but what I'd like to do to start, and as you can imagine, eventually we'll get to the abacus deal that's the subject of the SEC suit, but what I'd like to do first is could you just give me your educational and work background so I have an idea of who you are?
Sure. I went to law school, graduated Boston University School of Law in 1982, was in private practice from 1982 through the middle of 1984, out in the southwest, first of a firm in Albuquerque, Mexico, then with a small office at Kirkland & Ellis in Denver. Then I left to become an in-house counsel at a company called Ambac Indemnity, called Ambac Assurance. Never heard of it. I was there for, I don't know, 3 to 4 years, and left with a group of people to start a company called Capital Reinsurance Company, which was a specialty reinsurance company for the financial guarantee industry. I was general counsel there from roughly 1988 through the end of 1999, when Ace Limited, which is a multinational property casualty insurance company, purchased what was then Capital Re. And I left that company and was working for Ace Limited for about 3 to 4 years. Capital Re is now Assured Guarantee, which is a financial guarantee insurance company. I left Ace around April of 2004, and about a month later I took the job at ACA. I was the president and CEO of the holding company, ACA Capital Holdings, its principal operating subsidiary, which was the insurance company ACA Financial Guarantee, and its subs from, again, mid-2004 through October 8th of 2008, if I get that right, when we completed a restructuring with our creditors. The insurance company was, and its subsidiaries was left for the creditors to run off under different management board of directors. And I remained with the holding company up and through last November. There wasn't much left of the holding company, at which time I left my position there, and I'm on the board of directors of the holding company, but not currently employed.
Okay, so can you give me a general description of your job duties as president and CEO of ACA from May of 2004 until October of 2008?
Well, when I got there, my responsibilities was to raise capital for the company. It was going through a transition where it needed capital to maintain its rating of its principal operating subsidiary, the insurance company. And for financial guarantee insurers, the rating is the franchise. We were a very unique company in that we had an A-rated financial guarantor. And the first order of business was to raise capital to put the rating on firmer footing. We did that throughout the summer, successful in doing that, and that deal closed in September of 2004. That point forward, the operations were really three different businesses. right? The financial guarantee insurance company's principal business was to insure the principal interest on marginally investment grade and non-investment grade municipal obligations. Mm-hmm. Using its A-rated guarantee to upgrade the underlying rating of the bonds, which would sell at a higher price, lower yield, saving the issuer net interest costs over the life of the transaction in return for a premium. Mm-hmm. The second business was conducted under a sub of the insurance company, which is ACA Asset Management. That was the CDO Asset Management business, where we managed the collateral and CDO structures and CLO structures, collateralized loan obligations, collateralized debt obligations, corporate, asset-backed, leveraged loans, and principal those asset classes. That predated me. I moved forward with that business when I joined the company in 2004. And thirdly, we had a structured credit business where we wrote credit protection, most often on super senior tranches of cash and synthetic CDOs and CLOs. So that was kind of an analog to our financial guarantee business. We wrote it out of special purpose corporations, which were the obligations were guaranteed by the insurance company. Those were the three main businesses. Each one of those businesses had a separate operational head who reported to me. My background is more public finance. When I was a lawyer in private practice, I was a public finance lawyer, mm-hmm. some securitization, but mostly public finance. So when I came to the company ACA, you know, my expertise was really in line with the financial guarantee municipal bond business, although, you know, I know my way around securitization. I wasn't an expert in mortgage credit or things of that nature. We had experts hired to fill the gaps of my knowledge.
Okay. So who were the heads of the three businesses in this time frame, and if there was more than one, tell me.
Okay,
the time frame.
So my memory serves me well.
And
public finance, we'll call that municipal bond insurance business or public finance. It was a guy named Ruben Selles, S-E-L-L-E-S. And then he was replaced by a gentleman named Peter Hill, I'd like to say sometime in 2007. In structured credit, which is the business in which we wrote credit protection on super senior tranches, it was originally run by a guy named Bill Tomjanovic. I would spell his name if I could. Bill T, we called him. And he had two people reporting to him originally, Laura Schwartz, who then ran asset management, and then James Rothman, who then ran the functional division of structured credit. And then ultimately, Bill Tomjanovich left the company, and those two people, Laura Schwartz, became direct reports of mine, Laura running asset management, James Rothman running structured credit, throughout my tenure, basically.
Do you remember the timing when Bill T. left?
Bill T. left. Not exactly. I'd like to say the first quarter of 2006, but I could be wrong. Not cool. Exactly.
Okay, so when, how long, I believe you said, the CDO management business was going on before you got there, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And then, in terms of writing credit protection, was that going on before you got there?
Yes, it was.
Okay. In the 06-07 time frame, describe for me, if you can, you know, how ACA would determine whether or not to be a manager for a CDO.
Well, it was a competitive environment. There were many CDO managers, and the company would, through Laura and her team, meet with banks and investment banks who were sponsoring CDOs, mm-hmm. present our credentials, and become part of the competitive process to be selected as managers for CDOs that were coming to market or about to come to market.
Okay, and how would generally the company go about choosing collateral for CDOs?
Well, let's pick an asset class. Let's pick
subprime RMBS.
RMBS. Okay. Let's deal with ABS.
We didn't prepare him on that one.
Sorry.
At least you know. At least we speak the same language. There's a language barrier here. That's good. Laura, the asset management division, right, had a team of analysts, credit analysts, specific to certain asset classes, in this case, RMBS. A proprietary model by which they evaluated the credit profile of each one of those pieces of collateral. And a database of prior approved transactions and securities based upon what was already in some of our CDOs. And also who the originators were. And they would also go through and audit originators, mortgage originators, and RMBS sponsors. And through that qualitative and quantitative analysis, they would subject on a each security that was being considered for a specific CDO to determine whether it passed our credit criteria as to whether or not they would include it or not in the CDO. And every CDO had its contours, you know, which guided some of that selection process based upon what kind of CDO it was. If it was a high-grade ABS CDO, which meant that all the collateral would be A-minus or better rated predominantly, then, and from a certain, whatever, vintage perhaps, you would, you know, use those broad contours to look at the pool of securities that were out there that met those qualifying criteria, and then determine as a credit matter whether or not you want to include them within the CDO. And that was to my knowledge, an interactive process with the bank who was sponsoring the CDO, because they would take that aggregation of collateral and the structure, the bank would, and bring it to the rating agency to get rated based upon the rating agency model, which was a published model which people would use as, again, guidelines in the creation of the CDO. Now, I wasn't part of the selection process, nor on the credit committee that guided that. Again, that wasn't the area of my expertise. So I wasn't there day-to-day, and I was rarely there when it was being done, but that describes how it was done under Laura's management at the time.
Okay, so just make sure I get it.
Sure.
And I often don't. For certain types of asset classes, there is a pre-approved list by grade, like you mentioned, high grade and mezz, and then as deals come in.
Well, there was a list that was, like, we had approved the deal for a prior CDO.
Like a prior inventory. Inventory of prior deals.
We had let's assume, like, we had done a prior CDO that we were managing, right? And that's filled with collateral already, right? There may be these bonds in there where, right, that get on our approved list because they're approved for that deal. In the first instance, nothing was approved, right?
Right, right.
At day one. As you build up an inventory of approved names, which are constantly being reviewed and can either being continued to stay on the approved list or not, those represented a body of securities that you can select among, since they were approved at certain levels, to go into a subsequent CDO if they were available in the market. Mm-hmm. Add to that the incremental deals that were going to market and subjected to our credit criteria to determine whether or not they would pass the criteria or fail it.
So were there underwriters, or I should say MBS issuers, that you wouldn't buy from at all, or was it?
I don't know if we had anybody that we had a no on. We probably perhaps did, but we had a rank of, you know, people we liked better and those we disfavored. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we redlined anybody, but certainly we had our favorites.
Okay. So for, I mean, obviously we know a little bit about the 2007 AC1 deal since we've got some documents on that, and of course since the SEC has filed suit on that. But one of the things we saw in one of the allegations in the SEC suit is that in the beginning anyway, Paulson provides this listing of, I think, something like 100 bonds, and there's some email traffic back from Laura Schwartz that says we can okay 55 of them. Am I correct in assuming that so those 55 would have been in the pre-approved inventory for mezzanine grade bonds?
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, again, I wasn't part of that process, so I don't know exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, you can surmise that, you know, if some of that list overlapped with bonds we had already reviewed and had approved, that they would therefore be approved when we evaluated them again. So that overlap would be an approval in itself because we are already on our approval list.
Okay. And then other than having this pre-approval list, you mentioned something about a committee that would have to approve things. Did I hear you correctly?
Yeah, there was a credit committee for ABS housed within Laura's department that would meet and not only review names that were pre-approved on a weekly basis to see if they were continuing to be approved, because they would constantly refresh the database, but also go through new names as they were coming in and being suggested for any particular transaction.
Okay. What else was the committee's function, if anything, other than approving inventory?
Well, they approving prospective purchase credits. That's what they did. They did surveillance and approvals.
Okay. Did they have to approve ACA being a manager on a deal?
No, that's a separate committee. Okay. At a management level.
So who's on the credit committee?
Who was on that credit committee? Mm-hmm. It was made up of Laura and members of her team and credit, portfolio managers, but basically credit analysts, mortgage credit analysts. I would not even guess this to tell you who they were at
right.
the time.
Okay.
And that's
a
credit committee that you're talking about is the credit committee that says yay or nay to collateral for inventory.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, so there's a different committee, I take it, that has to approve whether or not ACA is going to be a collateral manager.
For any particular transaction, right. It started out, it morphed from, it used to be called the Senior Credit Committee, which was a bunch of corporate people and some of the department heads, and then it was called the Commitments Committee. So the Commitments Committee was the committee that Laura's team would bring a memo to in advance of formalizing an engagement and give a presentation to at the meeting to determine whether or not we would go forward with that engagement.
And so who was on that committee?
Give me a time frame.
06-07 time frame.
I was on it. The CFO was on it, likely Ted Gilpin. Our head of risk, which was independent of the departments, Joe Pimley, was on it. Our general counsel was on it. I don't know throughout the whole period whether she was on it, but Nora Dahlman was probably on it at some period of time. Maybe the head of municipal credit may have overlapped. I just don't recall the ins and outs of the number of years. But those four or five people I named were the...
Okay, in terms of ACA being a manager in a CDO deal, what is there other than the committee to approve collateral in general that can be part of a deal and the committee to actually approve ACA being collateral manager? What else do I not know about how it works at ACA?
How what works in the companies?
How it comes to be a CDO manager in any CDO.
Well, is that the whole process?
That's a process of us agreeing to do it, but the process of it getting to that point is, again, as I spoke before, a process between the bank and ACA, Laura's team, determining whether or not we're qualified, what our expertise is, what they're trying to accomplish, whether or not we might want to take equity in the transaction or not, which we did at times, mm-hmm. And less as we took less and less equity from 2004 on. It's a matter of strategy. We couldn't finance it effectively. I don't know what other, there may be some unique things. It could have been a bank balance sheet deal where, it depended on what kind of transaction.
For example, we know in the Abacus 2007 AC1 deal that you guys wrote, I think, $909 million CDS on the super senior tranche. How was that decision made at AC?
Okay, that's
whether or not to invest in the deal?
That's a separate transaction with a separate department. All right, so
can I just ask clarify the timeline, how this works, what comes first? So first I thought you said that if you're going to be the collateral manager, it kind of sounded like a competitive bidding process. You go to the sponsor as well as do other potential asset managers, and the selection's made at that point. And have you already decided that you'll be a manager, or?
No, we had a business, CDO Asset Management, so we were a manager.
Okay.
And the question was, go out and bid for business in the competitive environment of being CDO managers.
Okay, so then you get the bid. And then you start the process of...
We get the bid. Then we start the process of, should we accept it? Let's look at the deal. We have this commitments committee. They say yes or no. Let's assume they say yes. We're engaged. There's an engagement letter between the sponsor and ourselves saying, this is what goes on. If there's, if there's going to be warehouse risk taken by us or not, if it's a cash deal, all right, where there's actually assets being purchased, all right, who's going to finance that? Are we going to take any of the risk during that period? All that's negotiated before they, you know, you come to a deal. And that's one of the things that goes into whether or not you're selected, if you're willing to take warehouse risk or not, whether that's being offered. Once that's done,
right,
then the lights turn on, and Laura's department starts qualifying collateral to purchase into the warehouse, which will eventually turn into a CDO.
Okay, so the structure of the CDO and whether you'll retain risk or not is approved at the is set by the time you approve, yes, we're going to go forward.
That would all be in the memo.
And then the CDO is populated with assets through this process that you described.
Correct.
Okay, got it.
So back to the how a decision is made whether or not to make an investment in the deal.
Structured credit, third department. Municipal.
And actually, before that, sorry, just so nomenclature is clear, you were saying that you, in terms of whether or not you're going to do a deal, you would be negotiating with the sponsor of the deal?
It's typically the bank.
Okay.
But again, you know, and, you know, there's all kinds of structured finance transactions that were CDOs, collateralized debt or collateralized loan obligations or whatever, and it could be an investment bank with its own product. It could be a bank financing its balance sheet, a finance company financing itself, but doesn't have the CDO asset management skills, so all they have is assets, and they want to, it all depends on what kind of deal it was, I'm sure it is. So structured credit, three departments, public finance, we talked about that briefly, asset management, separately managed, structured credit, separately managed. Structured credit is where we write credit protection through credit default swaps on typically super senior positions and CDOs. That, right, business is the business flow that comes into that side of the company is from salespeople, typically at investment banks or people who are creating CDOs, to the contacts in the separate department run by James Rothman as to whether or not we want to write protection on any particular CDO, right? So those two things are, we're not always, we're rarely the manager, but we are the manager sometimes on a deal where we're looking at the super senior protection. But we did a lot of super senior transactions where we're not the manager, and we would evaluate the manager in that process. So that's a separate committee. That also has a senior credit committee with different people on it. Has a separate credit function and a separate risk function where we would expose the position that we were considering to our own proprietary modeling technique to determine whether or not we wanted to participate, and if so, how, and then how it should be priced in the negotiations between us and the counterparty.
Okay, so since we know the abacus,
sure,
take us through how the process worked on that ultimately led to taking the $909 million position.
So they didn't have the two transactions separated at the time. The first one was the transaction where we agreed to the credit selection agent. We weren't a manager on that deal. We didn't, all right, so the difference was we had a minor role on that transaction that we were just selecting collateral. It was a static synthetic. He asked me to explain it, so I'm jargon.
Yes.
So static means it was a fixed portfolio, wasn't going to be changed. It was what it was. It wasn't managed. There was no reinvestment, so it was static synthetic. There weren't cash bonds. It was all synthetic in that they were just referenced credits, referencing RMBS securities that were out in the market of certain vintages. So it was a static synthetic. And you know that was agreed to. And then we were approached, can't tell you how, but someone from Goldman on the sales side who covered us would approach the structured credit team and say, hey, listen, do you want to think about doing the super senior portion of this? Our guys probably would have said yes, and they would have begun the analysis, right? They would have looked at the bonds again, even though we were the manager, we'd have a separate guy. In this case, I think it was Dennis Kraft, look at the individual bonds, and then we'd have our quantitative guys subject the position to our modeling. They would write a memo to the senior credit committee, who would receive it in advance. We'd sit down, we'd look at the results of the modeling, we'd debate it, and then we'd make a determination. And you know, there's a lot of other things that are considered, you know, who the counterparty is, whether or not they'll take our credit, do we need an intermediary, what's the position, what are the collateral requirements, if any, what are the trick? All those things are usually detailed in that memo and discussed during that committee meeting.
Okay, and then you mentioned that Rothman is heading up this group at this time, right?
I believe so.
Okay. And I'm sorry, who mentions another name there a second ago that would have been looking at the collateral? And
Dennis Kraft.
Dennis Kraft.
And Joe Pimley, who was the head of risk, who would be in charge of running the model. His group would be in charge of running the model, right, for the person in structured credit who's, you know, championing the deal or looking at the deal, analyzing the deal.
And ultimately, to do the deal requires approval of
the committee.
Commitments committee, or whatever it's called.
This the separate committee, right. Senior Credit Committee for Structured Credit.
Okay. And your specific role in the Abacus 2007 AC1 transaction is what?
For which the first part? For the credit selection engagement.
Let's start there.
Just on the committee.
Okay.
Can I clarify one point here? You said, I understand, credit selection agent, but you are not the asset manager on this deal. Do we want to better understand how and what the differentiation is? That's also in the asset management business, not in structured.
So typically, our role was usually, most often, although we had many engagements in asset management, where we would select the collateral, and if the deal was a managed transaction, we would manage it going forward. Do the reporting, you trade out of credit impaired names at times and trade more in. If there was reinvestment period, you would reinvest cash coming in, you do other reports.
So, but if you're just a selection agent, you do the same thing that we talked about.
You
on
select
the front end.
And you're done.
Okay. Got it.
Okay, so understanding it's a static deal, you're done after the deal closes.
Oh,
you're
not. What was unique about this deal, if it was unique at all in my mind, is our role was very minor. Help us select this collateral. It's going to be static, not managed. Right.
So there's no manager.
There's no manager. There's a lot of static deals with no manager that people do, but there was no role for us other than that. So our, that's how we considered it at the time.
So, just again, I'm not in this industry at all. So it's a lot of remedial education. Static deals, does the CDO manager nevertheless, after the deal closes, issue a quarterly report?
The manager does, but we weren't the manager on the transaction. Sometimes there's no manager. It's just the trustee does it.
Okay.
Is a trustee for the collateral.
And was that the case here in Abacus 2007 AC1? Who's keeping the investors up to date on stuff after the deal closes?
Oh, not us. It was, I don't know, it was either the trustee report.
Okay.
I don't recall. But it wasn't us. We had no role post-selection.
Okay.
So what was the fee structure for a deal like that?
For this particular, I think it was 10 basis points. One of our, if you look at, I'm sure you have the commitments committee memo, one of the issues with pricing, how do we price this, because it's a minor role. But pricing was changing, throughout the years, all engagements.
Okay, so that explained how you guys selected the collateral.
So that was my role there. You asked me what my role was, right? So my role there was I was on the committee. Mm-hmm. That was it. I had conversations with Laura as the deal progressed, but not specifically on the transaction. It was like every week she'd tell me what's, in the pipeline, and we talk about each one of the transactions. So, and not much on this one because once our collateral selection was done, our role ended, basically. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't much to talk about on the asset management side. But I had to, that was my role. I was on the committee. On the other side, I was on the committee also. That was my role there.
Okay, so I mean, we know from the documents that you guys invested $42 million in the A2 note, and then
I don't recall that.
Really?
I don't know. I don't recall it.
We have proof.
I'm just kidding.
But that's what I read. I read that too. I just don't recall it.
I'll go back and look at the memo that went to the committee. I suspect it was in there. Tell me what you do recall in terms of
on the structured credit side,
in terms of the long deal. Yeah,
that we wrote super senior protection attaching a 50% to the top of the structure.
Okay. And who presents that investment to the committee?
There's a person in structured credit who would be the deal person in charge of the transaction, would write the memo under the supervision of her boss, and they would again have the quantitative guys look at the individual bonds, the quantitative guys look at the modeling, the qualitative guys look at the individual bonds. They would all be in the committee and present as the, on all the details of the transaction. And we talk about all the things.
At that time, what was the expected loss on the on that transaction?
Oh, we never expect losses. I mean, again, our posture, and I can probably speak for not just ACA, but the financial guarantee insurance industry on, mm-hmm. on super senior
bonds. Why don't you just
But I'll speak to myself.
Speak up.
Was that, you know, we, that there was, you know, we were providing, you know, hedges on market volatility to institutional counterparties. Mm-hmm. We knew that pricing would change and we can absorb that, but our analysis told us at the time that there was no expectation of dollar loss content in those tranches.
So you might have seen hypothetically that at some point in time there might be a dip in fair value, so, but that it would recover.
Right, because we were positioned, we believed, to take the volatility because we didn't have to typically post collateral against the changes in market value to our counterparty, number one. Number two, we were told by the rating agencies that who rated us that that mark-to-market variation, right, was not important to our own rating from a financial strength point of view on the insurance company. Ignore it. Don't worry about it.
So you understand I'm not trying to keep anything from you. I just don't want some congressional committee saying, we're going to ask him, you know, he claims he is the spokesman for the financial industry.
I don't want to be the spokesman.
It's Congress that is of concern to me. Go ahead.
So,
tell nice folks everything you they want to know.
So, so we felt uniquely positioned to absorb that market volatility for a premium, believing that we did believe, based on our own independent analysis, that that there was no dollar loss content in our exposures. And on top of that, it was very capital efficient because the rating agencies, when viewing us on our financial strength rating of the insurance company, right, really applied minimum capital requirements for those super AAA positions. Matter of fact, the capital was less than the premium we were charging. So it was a capital efficient way to assume that risk also. So again, if this is a little too complicated, just tell me to slow down on that.
Well, I'm just fascinated. So you kind of look at the rating agency as a regulator because they're the ones who are telling you what the right capital is. And
well, we have two regulators. We have our state insurance department regulators.
State insurance department and the
and we have the rating agencies are our regulators only because whether it's us or a AAA or AA financial model, guarantee monoline, mm-hmm. that's our franchise. We must maintain the rating to provide value in our, especially in a public finance business. So we abide by their model, their depression model for analyzing the capital adequacy of financial guarantee insurance companies. Mm-hmm. And each one of those models has individual capital charges based upon our exposures.
Is this an okay direction to
go? Yes.
Okay.
Did you have more?
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Are there other instruments similar to this that the capital requirement is less than the premium?
Well, any highly rated structured finance tranche would have, if it's all rating based, would have capital requirements that were lower than lower rated tranches, and depending on how much you could charge, that would describe the dynamic between capital charge and premium.
So Abacus 2007 AC1 is a synthetic deal. What do you know at the time you're deciding to write the CDS about who's taking the short side of the transaction?
I know that my counterparty is short.
But do you know who that counterparty is?
Goldman Sachs is always the dealer is always my counterparty. So of all, aside from Abacus AC1, every super senior position we did, our counterparty was some institution. And they were synthetic deals. By definition, sure.
Right. And so did you understand, though, that in this deal and other deals, that, well, that was initially the case that often that short position was then laid off to someone else?
Clearly. Clearly, their nets, they were not, may not have been net short, but, you know, that's...
That's how the deals are put together.
Not only that, I mean, they're a financial institution. This one transaction fits into their portfolio of credit. In a variety of ways, right? And what their net short position is against that asset class, you know, is nothing that I could possibly even you know, to think of describing in a way that is meaningful to us.
Okay. So when do you, I mean, everybody knows about this transaction now, when do you first find out that, that Paulson's actually taken the $1.2 billion?
When the SEC filed its complaint.
Okay. So do you have, I know from the papers.
Whenever that Friday was.
Right. Like the 26th, I think. We've seen in the documents anyway, both in the complaint and otherwise, that of course Paulson was involved in the selection of the collateral. Did you know that at the time?
Everything I know about the transaction, I know from people at ACA. I never had a conversation with anybody at Goldman from it. I never had a conversation with anybody from Paulson. I only met some people from Paulson once at a meet and greet. I didn't even know who they were. I mean, I didn't know what we call it anymore. So I really don't know anything about, you know, the day-to-day on the transaction, you know, as was represented to me by, you know, Laura and her team. I knew they were involved in the process. I was believing them to be long. The Commitments Committee memo expressly represented that, as did subsequent emails and memos on the same transaction. My instruction to Laura and her team after the Commitments Committee was, you know, I don't care who it is, put the collateral through the same processes and the same analysis we put every other piece of collateral for any other transaction, and come up with your list of bonds. And if they, you know, if there's overlap between you and the guy that's there, fine. You know, we believe our interests to be consistent, if he's long. And if there's not, then, you know, pick what you think is the ones that you want to pick. That's, you know, you shouldn't be influenced by the presence of third parties.
Okay. Then did it make a difference? Would it have made a difference in terms of the long investment by ACA if you had known that Paulson was going to be shorting the deal?
That's a complex question because we have two transactions, right? If I had known he was shorting the deal, the first question to me, in my mind, that pops up is, would we have accepted the engagement as collateral selection agent? And the answer to that one is probably no, because if you read our Commitments Committee memo, we're all worried about reputational risk and the need to, right, at least have to be uninfluenced. I won't say objective, it's a bad word, uninfluenced by outside parties in our selection process. So if I didn't do that, so if I had then, that would have led me to decline the asset selection engagement. Then does the super senior transaction even come to me? I mean, I don't know what I'm trying to say.
I'm following you.
So, and if it does, then I don't know, then I don't know who's involved in the selection process because it wasn't me. Because I would have declined that. So it's a hard, ask me a hypothetical, it's hard for me to even understand how to process through my mind because I can't separate that other transaction. Of course I know he's involved. But if you're telling me now, assume he's short, then he wouldn't have been involved because we wouldn't have been involved on this side of it. On this side of it, you know, as a purely objective point of view, looking at the collateral, look at the analysis we did, we liked the risk at the time. If someone identifies their net short position to me behind the dealer and we make further inquiry, the result of that inquiry may go anywhere. We may not do the deal, may do the deal. It all depends on what that client's motivation is. So I can't hypothesize as to what those conversations would have been.
But isn't it true? I mean, you have these, they were all accepted by the committee, the assets that were, you know, picked in whatever process. So
our committee.
By your committee, yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, even knowing Paulson's involvement doesn't change the assets.
But I wouldn't have been there with him in the process in the first instance, mm-hmm. because it's, if someone came to me and said, "Hey, listen, we want to put together a short portfolio with you," right? And that's the direction. We weren't in the business of doing that. Mm-hmm. So we would have went to committee with that. Laura would have come to committee with that. Hey, this guy wants to put together a short portfolio. So he said, "Well, we're not in the business of doing that. We don't want to."
Is that because implicitly your job is to represent the buy side, the long side?
In a managed deal, this wasn't a managed deal. We're right. We have an obligation to the transaction as a whole. And this we didn't after it was selected. We had no continuing involvement. So it would have been odd for us.
I don't understand the distinction there. So if you have an ongoing manager role, that's different from having a static
Once we selected the collateral, let me back up. Mm-hmm. Our job was done. We had no continuing involvement. Mm-hmm. When you're a manager, even if it's a static deal, right? Because if it's a static deal, you sometimes have to sell credit impaired names. You don't reinvest, it just flows through the waterfall. Mm-hmm. There's things you can do and report. You have an obligation to the transaction as a whole to manage it, right, as well for the equity as for the super senior guys. Mm-hmm. Right. So now we didn't have a continuing obligation to any of the holders. So it's a hard hypothetical. I mean, I don't know how to answer it because we knew he was involved. If he was short, we wouldn't have been involved here. So I never get to the second transaction, which was actually later in time than the first one.
I'm just thinking if I was an investor, I wouldn't want to have a deal managed by a static manager because there's nobody with an ongoing responsibility. I'm getting a greater fiduciary support from an ongoing deal.
In a synthetic deal, right?
There's really nothing to manage.
In a synthetic deal, right, the long positions... The economic position of the long, right, mm-hmm. is 100% in conflict with the economic position of the short. But the short knows the long, and the long knows the short. Mm-hmm. One has no superior position than the other. Just because you're long, you're not the good guy, and the short's the bad guy. They just on two sides of the bet, mm-hmm. you know? So I think that's where sometimes people get hung up, is that they think the long deserves some deference to the short in a synthetic deal where, listen, your view of the market may be bad, yours may be positive. Am I to select who's the good guy or the bad guy? No, you have different views of the market.
So is there a difference between how ACA goes about approving / selecting collateral, whether it's a static deal or a managed deal?
No.
Okay.
Is it more about pricing? Pricing, how much you get paid, whether you're manager or selector.
That was market forces drove pricing to the manager. I mean, again, a very competitive environment. You kind of knew where the market was for any particular asset class. CLOs, ABS CDOs, and TREPS, REIT preferred CDO. I mean, everybody, it was pricing for everything.
So would ACA have, I take it ACA would have reviewed the offering circular before it decided to invest in the deal?
I'm sure our law firm did. Okay. I mean, our law firm, our internal counsel did.
Okay. Because I think the commitments memo says, you know, we think Paulson's going to invest in the 0-9% equity tranche.
That's what was
represented. If you look at the offering circular, it's unfunded.
I didn't look at the offering circular.
Well, I know, but I understand you didn't. But has that ever been a point of discussion since the deal? Like, hey, you know, the commitments memo said Paulson was going to be long in the first loss tranche, and yet the offering circular shows it's unfunded.
No, not to my knowledge.
You just didn't know.
To my knowledge, it never came up. I don't recall it ever coming up.
When the memo seeking approval for the deal comes in, is the offering circular attached?
No, it wasn't. It wouldn't have been done then.
Because the circular is a few months later, I guess. So if the circular has something that's different from the memo, do you get a chance to say, forget this?
I wasn't involved with this process, so I don't know what was represented, because I've never seen it, actually, until...
So the 26th of April, perhaps, maybe even after that.
I haven't released.
The facts come to your.
I never saw it until late.
Your committee, somebody else has presumably vetted.
As someone who's not in the industry, this is another thing that's a little surprising: is that there can be an unfunded equity tranche. I mean, it seems to be one of the assurances an investor has is that there's someone else who's going to.
Well, again, you have to.
And again, this is a synthetic blinders I've got to put on.
Well, it's a synthetic transaction. These work two different ways, but. Think of a synthetic transaction as people as a way for people to express their views in the market, mm-hmm. right? Even if they don't own the physical security, whether it's on one piece of corporate credit or a synthetic asset-backed CDO, mm-hmm. and there's reason for that, right? People, some people only want to hedge their portfolio positions. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you do that in this market? If you have a lot of risk and you're a financial institution and you want to manage mortgage risk, how do you do that? I just leave that as an open question. Mm-hmm. You sell houses? I mean, how do you do it? There's not too many indices out there that you can play in. that are reflective of your book. So you have to express your view with instruments that are available in the market or made available in the market.
So that brings up an interesting question, which is that the volumes of indexes seems to be a lot greater than the volumes of synthetic CDOs. So I guess, I mean, it's kind of like somebody made this analogy. It's kind of like money market mutual funds versus buying an ETF. You can buy the managed portfolio of CDS, or you can just buy the index. For the index trading, the volume seems to be greater. So why did people buy synthetic CDOs?
I mean, it depends whether or not the index is representative of where you are. I mean, the index is about 40 bonds.
It's what?
40 bonds?
Yeah.
No, it happened in retrospect to be very representative. Who knew it did not? And I don't know about, you know, I don't know much about the index and the volumes and liquidity and whether it was all real or not. I can't comment on it. I just don't know about ADXHE, you know.
So is this the memo that would have come to you guys about possibly taking the long position?
Dated February 27th.
This would have been the first version, if this is correct, of the one that went to the committee. This deal lingered for a number of months before it got...
Right, and I will tell you that, at least according to another listing I have, that you guys, ACA, at least purchased the $42 million A2 note...
Into where?
...on April 10th. And that settled on April 26th, the date of the offering circular. And then you guys again, ACA.
Again, if we did, I don't recall it.
Sure.
I guess that's what
I say this, see if it jogs memory bells. And then according to this listing, the $909 million, actually that date has ABN AMRO, so that's not necessarily the date that you guys did it, because they intermediated it afterwards. But that was May. But all I want to do is really try to understand maybe how the process worked. The day before that commitment memo, February 26th, we have both this term sheet and this flip book. Would that have been included with the commitment memo, do you recall? Was that just as a matter of course, the way it worked at ACA?
No, it wouldn't have. Well, I would have received most typically just that.
Just the memo?
Yeah, and again, I don't recall seeing these documents.
Okay.
I mean, sometimes maybe people brought them into the meeting. I don't know. I don't know. It's not familiar to me as I look at them today.
Do you get the memo ahead of time?
Typically, we urged our people to do that. And in most cases, they were good about it.
Now, did you guys, I don't know why I keep saying you guys, did you or the folks at ACA know that IKB was going to be a long investor in the deal?
I was not aware of that.
But let me ask you something else.
Sure.
Would the decision to invest in the deal have been made on February 27th, 2007?
I don't recall whether it was or was not. I mean, that was its first presentation. I don't think we did the deal until much later, so.
Right. I mean, it's certainly not until 2 months later. And,
right.
And just, not just this deal, but otherwise, how does that work?
Does it come back to you for a final?
Oh, it keeps coming back as it changes for a number of reasons. One, because pricing will change based upon our modeling. So it has to come back at least on pricing, no matter if there's any significant time. Two, it may be, we may be in negotiations on attachment point, on other terms. In this case, there was an intermediary. The discussions with the intermediary were ongoing, and we may have not been coming to terms with them. So every time anything would change, they would keep moving it forward until it was ready to be presented in final. Or if the structure was approved in general, they would just bring back the pieces that had to fill in. But again, we'd go through the approval process again.
So was ACA's investment, the $909 million investment in the deal, always conditioned upon being able to intermediate out to ABN AMRO?
To have an intermediary, yes.
Yeah.
So in terms of Paulson's role, you understood he was involved. Do you have any, can you provide any color of what you understood his role to be?
Other than...
His name came up, they were involved, he was involved how?
I didn't know him from a hole in the wall, quite frankly. He was not meaningful to me. The name was not meaningful to me. It was just another hedge fund in the world who was, taking a position as CEO. And I was not part of any of the conversations. All I know is what Laura told me, and, from my perspective, I hate to say unremarkable because it was a large exposure transaction, but it was not one of the transactions that took up a lot of my time. And I just, once we finished the selection process and the super senior position kind of was in process and kind of going away because it couldn't get done, I was, this deal wasn't even something that was on my radar screen.
So after the deal closes, I know it's intermediated, but when do you first hear about the downgrades and losses on the deal?
Me?
Yeah. Or do you hear about the downgrades and the losses on the deal?
No, I mean, at the time, I don't know what our aggregate ABS super senior position was, but it was big, tens of billions of dollars. I would be informed of tranche downgrades on our exposed positions or tranches below our positions that were meaningful as a matter of course by the heads of the department relevant to the transactions. But I don't, recall someone coming to me and saying, hey, listen, Abacus AA's got downgraded. I couldn't even tell you, what tranches got downgraded in this transaction and when. There are other transactions that probably were developing negatively earlier than this one, but I'm going to only speculate as to my memory, when that occurred.
Sure, and I don't have it in front of me, but I think the allegation in the SEC complaint is that by October of 07, just a scant 6 months after the deal closed, 83% of the collateral had been downgraded, and I think by January of the next year, it's over.
But by January of the next year, I'm in a restructuring with creditors already. Mm-hmm. This is not something that's really even a thought for me.
And just all I meant by the October 07 reference is, does that jog memory bells about hearing 6 months after we take this investment, whether it's in the A2 notes or whether it's in the intermediated CDS deal, there's been this downgrade of just about all the collateral?
No, not at all. No recollection. I don't think that's I can't recall that ever coming up on this transaction.
Okay.
Or any other transaction, quite frankly, that we were involved in. I mean, we were monitoring our book of business, right, on a structured credit side, transaction by transaction. But there were other ones that were, again, developing negatively earlier than this one. But this one holds no special, role as being a leader in that category.
Any discussions with anyone at Goldman after the deal closes and ACA makes its investment?
About this deal? Not by me.
Any discussion with anyone at Paulson by you after the deal closes?
Never.
Okay. Including after you hear about Paulson's short position the date that the SEC sues?
I mean, no.
Since April 26th of this year.
Oh, no. No. No one's even listening.
Were there, I don't have it with me, but I think I have a listing of the deals ACA has done. Were there other deals where you guys were just the selection agent and not a manager on a deal?
Not that I recall. We just had a minor role. Not that. There were deals. Oh, let me hold back. I'm Bill Brook. Just trying to check my memory. Not that I recall.
Okay. So, and again, a lot of this is me just reacting to you telling me new information that I haven't heard before. So given that, at least to the best of your recollection, normally ACA is involved as a manager and not just a selection agent. Does that jog any memory bells in terms of discussions with Goldman or internal people at ACA about, here's this unusual deal that's coming for 10 basis points for us to just basically approve 90 bonds?
Again, the only discussion I had on this deal was with people internal at ACA. So all I can tell you about is my discussions with Laura or her group or people on structured credit. Right? And when the deal came in, I said, well, if they said it's a static synthetic, I said, that doesn't really need a manager. There's plenty of static synthetic deals that can get done with no managers because there's really nothing to do other than the reporting, and the reporting is the ministerial function afterward.
Okay.
right? Because you get what you get, period. So the thought was, hey, if they want us to do that, fine. How much should we charge for it? And let's make sure everything's fine. And that, and the commitments committee was is impaneled to make sure that everything is as represented. And at the time, we believed it to be.
Nothing so more what, else, that. What else would a CDO manager do on a static deal other than just select the collateral?
Some static deals allow you to trade out of credit-impaired positions, right? Things of that nature. And you have to spot them, trade out of them. There's stuff to do. You don't get paid a lot for it. But there's a lot of financial institutions that just don't want to be bothered with it. They rather have, for whatever few basis points they have to pay, to have a third party do it for them.
Okay, and so again, just for remedial education for me, and how is that different from either a managed or what I've heard referred to as a dynamic deal?
Oh, because there's a reinvestment period. Cash comes in from deals that the underlying collateral is paying off. You have to reinvest it, and you have to manage the credit profile. There's a lot, you know, there's stuff to be done.
So explain.
It's a lot of cash flow running through these are big transactions.
Sure. So you mentioned earlier that there's, whether it's static or managed, or whether you're just a selection agent or managing it going forward, that there's no difference, tell me if I'm right, in how you guys go about selecting the collateral. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's generally correct. If this was a bank balance sheet deal, I would say no.
So who?
If you understand the difference, right?
Well, I think so, but go ahead. Explain it.
Because finance companies and banks sometimes finance themselves by issuing CDOs, and the collateral is their own portfolio of RMBS or their own portfolio of loans in the CLO cases. And so they finance themselves. Sometimes bank may come to a CDO manager and say, I'm going to finance my balance sheet. I'm going to retain X of the equity. I want to create a CDO out of everything else, right? We'll sell it. You'll manage it. You'll be the third party doing all the administrative stuff because we don't know how to do that. And we'll pay you for it. But it's our assets, and this is the collateral.
So it's
all the collateral specified. You don't have to play with it then, but you still have to get it rated, so you have to deal with the rating agencies. They would have to in determining, based upon the portfolio, right, and the structure of the transaction, you know, what the correct level of subordination is, what the diversity requirements are, all the things that go up into leading a rating agency to make those determinations.
So am I right then that you wouldn't be financing your balance sheet on any synthetic CDO because it's just reference collateral, right? Okay, so on a cash CDO, for example, I don't think Goldman vertically integrated. They didn't own an originator, but it made warehouse line loans to subprime loan originators and then bought those loans from the subprime loan originators and had those in their inventory as they were getting ready to securitize a deal. With that, I'm not saying ACA did this, but is that an example of doing balance sheet financing?
No.
And that, and, okay.
Yeah,
what am I missing?
Whole balance sheet, certain categories on the balance?
It's typically a portfolio lender. What you described to me, and I don't know anything about what you said, but I'm just taking it at face value, is, you know, they had assets in warehouse for CDO originations. I'm saying people who are portfolio lenders, which otherwise weren't creating CDO products. Instead of, if you're a mid-market leverage lender to mid-market companies, right? You got to finance yourself. You make all these loans and you're out of financing. What do? You have them all on your balance sheet as assets. You can make a CLO out of them. And then that way you can re-equitize your balance sheet, right, and start again. But you would use all your collateral.
Right.
It would be pre-selected.
Okay. Right, you're just generating cash by moving stuff off the balance
sheet. By selling it, you're selling it out to the market. So that's a balance sheet deal. That's how we would think. Banks do that, have done that to them in the past.
I get that. All right. So explain to me on if the collateral selection process isn't different, whether you manage going forward or not, what kind of comfort am I getting as an investor, since I could be either one on the short side or one on the long side? I'm trying to understand what the collateral manager does and if there's any kind of duty. Is there?
You have to describe the transaction. What was it, static?
Let's use the Paulson one, right?
I
mean,
our role ended when we selected the collateral. We had no continuing role.
I understand that, and all I'm getting at is the actual job of selecting that collateral, approving those 90 bonds, however many there were, that were the reference collateral for the deal. Mm-hmm. like you said, you know, we've got a short investor, we've got a long investor on this deal. So what's the criteria for approving, or selecting the reference collateral?
All I can tell you is what our criteria was, right? Our criteria was we had a credit model and fundamental credit analysts would go through and try to select what we believe to be, right, the best, if you will, the collateral which would likely perform better, right, over time than other collateral for that particular transaction. That's how we viewed it,
okay,
in the absence of anything else.
Okay.
Now, we were profoundly wrong, but you know something, I don't think there was much variation between the performance of RMBS of that vintage collateral, no matter what was selected at the end of the day, but that's 100% high side. The best, I don't say it.
That's
the answer, I guess, right? Because when you think about it, there's a long and the short, right? No one's good at that. If the short selects all the collateral, then you can say, well, it's biased towards the long's point of view. If the long selects all the collateral, then it's biased from the short's point of view.
But it sounds like,
I don't know. It's kind of theoretical.
I'm the non-CDO guy here. It sounds to me like, since you're trying to select the collateral that you think is going to perform the best, that you are sort of aligned with the long investor and not the short investor. They have different views, but it sounds like what you're selecting is stuff that you're believing is going to perform well.
Our criteria is based on our underwriting criteria for individual collateral. My understanding is from Laura and her group that it was, the selection was based upon what we believe to be the best, if you would, collateral, based upon the confines, the criteria set up for the CDO. It was 2006 and 2007, mezzanine rated ABS. You know, we would select what we believe to be likely to be the best performing collateral in the future from that pool of candidates.
Okay. Generalized questions that you may or may not know, but we're asking all folks like you this. In terms of the market in general, was there a change from cash CDO to synthetic CDO at any point in time that you saw?
A change in?
In deals going from cash to synthetic.
Change in quality of deals?
I don't know what you're saying. The speed of when it occurred.
The types of deals actually being done, was the over time were more deals synthetic deals than cash deals?
Not to my knowledge. I wasn't viewing the entire market. You know, I look at some of the statistics and volumes, but I don't recall looking at the breakdowns and the trends. But I couldn't tell you.
Okay. What about trends in terms of deals just drying up? Period.
Drying up. Period.
When did they stop?
I don't know. June of 2007.
And
essentially, maybe it was later than that. Sometime around it.
And why do you think that was?
Well, I think the performance statistics were becoming known, and they can no longer be debated. All right. If you look at the beginning, from our perspective, the first quarter of 2007, there were a lot of people on both sides of the equation as to what the ultimate performance would be of this asset class. And again, the indexes rallied in April after a pretty sharp decline in the beginning and toward the end of the first quarter. So people were, the debate raged heavily. I won't speak for anybody but myself and my company at the time, but I mean, if you read the literature from the street, coming out of the street those days, from the research side, right, you had every opinion that you would want to have had, you could read about. There were doomsayers, there were those saying all won't be that bad, including members of the federal government in high places, right, saying all won't be that bad. So the opinion was scattered. So what as time went on, more information is known and the opinions become less scattered.
For, in terms of cash CDOs, was a lot of the collateral for cash CDOs tranches of other CDOs?
Some structures allowed for up to a percentage of the collateral being other CDOs. I don't know what the percentages were with them. There was a bucket which the rating agencies allowed where you can have up to X percent other CDOs. And of course there were CDO squares which were made up of nothing but other tranches of other CDOs.
One of the things we've been seeing is on some of the CDOs we've been looking at, when we've tracked, we've seen long investors buy, you know, $300 million of the various A, B, C, D tranches, and ultimately we see those long investors just shoving those into other CDOs and not actually buying them as an investment.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, since you were in the industry, if you saw that, if you saw any trends like that over time.
You know, there was emerging evidence that there, you know, always how much hard money was actually in the transaction, the ultimate investors, and how much it was just, you know, the next generation of CDOs or CDO squareds, right? So, you know, that I can't tell you that I was seeing that trend, but you would see that occurring, and the question became, you know, was raised, I think, in conversation. Hey, you know, how much of this hard money is still around, and how much is it just, you know, being placed into a next structure? Ultimately, it had to be sold. But I didn't, you know, I can't say that there was a point in time where there was no hard money in the market. Because we didn't know much about, so again, we didn't sell CDOs. We were managers. People said to me many times before, well, you know, the market was getting jumpy, were you worried? I said, well, on the asset management side, our focus as a business, and me as a business manager, was, well, where's our next asset management engagement coming from? The sale of the CDO and the tranches, that's indirectly affecting our business. If ABS CDOs stopped and the CLO business continued on, fine, we'd concentrate more on CLOs or Trump's, you know, we can change asset classes depending on where the volumes were. So for us, the strategic decision was asset management. We weren't selling CDOs. We never, that wasn't our business.
Well, it was also, but the structured credit was a big part of the business, the super senior tranche.
Right, but again, by asset class, I mean, if we, depending on where what was out there, we would look at CMBS deals, we would look at, you know, trust, whatever it may be. There was always a structured finance transaction with a AAA tranche and a super AAA hedge needed to be put in place, theoretically. Mm-hmm. So it just meant, you know, where we, volumes may go down, fine, we'll have a slower year. I mean, that's the reality of the business.
So when did you start being worried about your super senior exposure? You know, on the structured credit side?
Worried in what sense?
Worried that you're going to lose
money. Perfect?
That you're going to lose money on it.
You know, it's strange. My company got downgraded in December of 2007. Right. So from that moment on, it was about a workout with creditors, which we were successful in doing.
Mm-hmm.
August of 2008. You know, by that time, the mark-to-market volatility of the portfolio was tremendous. We put a big mark through our income statement as a result of that volatility. There were no losses,
mm-hmm.
but that volatility was the, like I said it before, the distant thunder, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have a light bulb moment. I had, hey, you know, in this business you have to be perfect, and we may not have been perfect. That's probably the understatement of the decade.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there were some people still convinced that ultimate net losses, ultimately, would be manageable, even into the third quarter, fourth quarter of 2007.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, you know, as you went to 2008, we knew ultimately some of those positions would not pay off. But at that point in time, the company was being unwound. So, you know, it's a long way from zero to your attachment point, and it's a long way for a mortgage default and a foreclosure to translate into a RMBS default in the tranche that you're interested in, and a long way from that turning into a default in the tranche in the CDO of which the RMBS tranche is a collateral.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a slow-moving train, and the statistics come out every month on mortgage remittances, right? Again, are three generations removed from whether or not your attachment point may be reached, maybe four generations removed. So, you know, it doesn't lend itself to, oh, we're going to lose all this money.
Mm-hmm.
It emerges over time, in my mind.
Sure. So I asked you earlier, and you said that's a tough hypothetical to answer, because if I had known Paulson or shorting the deal, I don't know that we would have even accepted the asset manager position, so the long investment may not have even come our way. I have heard from others that, and I maintain the confidentiality of interviews, just like I will this one, that it was ACA's position, I don't know if it was your position personally, that had ACA known that Paulson was shorting the deal, it would not have made the long investment in the deal. Have you ever said that to anyone or expressed that opinion?
I think my opinion has been, if we had known that Paulson was short the deal and not long the equity, right, that would have lent, and he would have been, and he was identified to us by our counterparty, Goldman Sachs. Meet your my net position, Paulson, and by the way, he's not. Then, you know, we would have had made further inquiry. Okay, who is this guy? I don't know him, so I'd like to know why he's short, and had a conversation as to why he was going short. And again, I'll take you back to this a little earlier in this interview. Our business was to provide hedges to institutional counterparties on mark-to-market volatility. We didn't think there was ever going to be dollar loss content in these tranches. We were wrong, profoundly wrong. But so if we had learned through that process, whoever my people were, that, hey, this guy has an investment thesis. He actually thinks he's going to collect on this bet. And it's not just a hedge on volatility. Then we would have gathered around and said, hey, you know, do we agree with this guy? Is this guy possibly right or wrong? And unless we strongly disagreed with that hypothesis, right, then maybe we wouldn't have done the deal. Because at that time we would have had a person. His identity alone meant nothing to us. What's meaningful to us is what's the motivation, and once we learn that motivation, in this case, he's going to win the bet, then it would lead us to question, and I'd be sitting there with my credit guys, do you believe in me? They probably all would have said he was a kook at that time, right? Because no one was really taking the position to that extreme. But it would have led to some healthy debate, and at that point in time, right, we would have said, hey, and I can't get this thing that he was there at the outset out of my mind now and saying, maybe the whole thing just doesn't add up. Why is he sitting with us in the room during the selection process? Now he's telling us he's going to win the bet. So all those factors could have come together unlikely, and we just said, no, we're not going to do the deal. Now then again, I was only one vote. We could have said,
could have gone ahead anyway,
because we liked the deal. We said, this guy's a crook. Don't worry about it. Goldman's taking 5% or whatever. That could have very well happened also, but you know, it's all in the inquiry and what the inquiry would have exposed. And if he exposed his thesis to us, we'd have to sit around and talk about it. And at that point, who knows? We might, you know, it's likely that we wouldn't have done the deal because it wasn't our business to line up against the guy who's making directional bets.
Right. Anything else?
I have something on the tip of my tongue. I guess. Well, one thing that's interesting is the Treasury proposal was to require risk retention in all structured deals. So it's interesting that in the CDO business, at least, it seems that over time, and ACA is an example of this, you would have an equity tranche habitually when you did deals, but over time you stopped doing that. And should we read something into that? I mean,
when the company originally got into the CDO asset management business in, I guess, 2002, 2003, and it took a large portion of the equity that enabled them to win mandates, I guess, because they put a lot of capital where their risk was, mm-hmm. where their management was. We were a relatively small company. We had just raised $170 million to get our capital base to the point where we can retain our rating. Mm-hmm. It was very inefficient for the insurance company to invest in equity because that carried a very high capital charge. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it would eat up resources which could ultimately threaten our rating or make us less comfortable with our rating. We didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. So part of the reason was, hey, listen, it's not an efficient use of our capital, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two is it's not a good way for us to finance it anyway. Mm-hmm. So, and now that we have a track record as a manager, we don't need to take as much equity. Mm-hmm. All those things came together, and we just were able to take less and less. It wasn't zero; it was just very small pieces, $1 million here, $2 million here. That was a business strategy.
Okay. How is your capital charge? The way you calculated that was based on
what the rating agencies told us it was. That's what we calculated.
Okay, so I'm actually. A bank supervisor, and I know what our regulatory capital standards are. I don't really know much about what rating agencies expect from.
Yeah, I mean, I can't sit here and lecture about it because I just don't have enough knowledge to do that, but I can refer you to S&P every year rated all the monoline financial guarantee insurers.
Mm-hmm.
And every year they put out something called the bond book. And the first 15 pages of the bond book is their rating methodology and model and capital charge methodology for monoline financial guarantee insurers, and you can school yourself quite well by just reading through that.
Okay.
It's pretty thick stuff. But
that's helpful. But, I mean, in retrospect, was it right to trust them?
Well, it's not to trust them. That was, you know, I understand. It's in the financial guarantee business, you needed the rating, so you had to get it.
Right.
It's not a question of trust. That was the business. It was, you know, based upon your rating, you can upgrade municipal bonds and other securities.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, it was the franchise. You had to be rated or not be in the business, so that was just part of the deal. And it was called the financial strength rating. It was institutionalized throughout the industry. Mm-hmm. What remains of it?
One industry question you may or may not know about. You mentioned that, or your CDS that you wrote, that you didn't have to post collateral if the securities, the underlying assets were marked out, that you would only be posting collateral if your super senior position was underwater. Is that correct?
No, actually not. We had three flavors, but basically they were loss-based triggers, rating-based triggers, right, mm-hmm. or no triggers. No triggers that didn't matter what the mark was, we never had to post collateral against the counterparty. They treated us like, okay. In most cases, we had a rating-based trigger. In other words, if our rating fell below A minus into the triple B category, then it would trigger a collateral call.
Okay.
Or a loss-based trigger. Even we may have attached that at a particular tranche, let's say 35%. If losses reach 25%, I'm making a hypothetical here, we may have had to start posting collateral at that point, or there was a combination of the two.
So that loss mark, whatever it is, could be established contract to contract.
Right, and we tried to keep consistency so that we can make a representation to everybody that basically everybody's trading with us on the same terms, which was kind of right. And when we got downgraded in December of 2007, we were out of business, not because there were no losses in all these tranches, even though there's volatility. Again, it was a slow-moving train, because we got downgraded below A minus and all the collateral calls became present. And we had $400 million equity and a few billion dollars of collateral calls, and those two things just didn't match up very well.
Okay, so it wasn't uncommon for you to have to post collateral at an attachment point below the attachment point that you wrote the
right. It wasn't uncommon, but it was in some cases that was true.
So others in the industry would have potentially had the same types of arrangements?
Well, by industry, do you mean the monoline financial guarantee industry?
No, just financial guarantee industry more broadly, not necessarily just the monoline.
Well, I don't know who they are outside the monolines. I would describe, you know, the AMBACs, the MBIAs, the FIDGICs, may they all rest in peace, of this world. Many of them had rating-based triggers.
Mm-hmm.
Some didn't. Some went trigger-free. I can't really speak exactly to how they structured their transactions. I just don't know. So, but, you know, that industry traded differently against counterparties and other financial institutions, to my knowledge.
So, I mean, is there a future for the monoline industry? It's still doing munis, right? I mean, it's still in the core that it started with.
Well, there's one company left, Assured Guarantee. The old Capital Re, is now Assured Guarantee. There is one company remaining that's writing new business, and it's mm-hmm. only rated AA. Penetration rates are down from 50% of municipal issuance, which is 100% of the insurable universe, A-rated credits and above, to like 8%. I don't think so, but I'm one opinion in that. I mean, capital charges are higher, the range of opportunities are smaller. It's hard to generate equity returns on capital for those businesses from a fresh start. Assured is fortunate as they have an embedded book of business which will produce equity returns over time. I think in this environment, you know, the business can't expand into other areas because the criticism is that's exactly what caused your problems in the first instance, expanding outside of the muni space. So, whatever. I mean, I don't think it's a very bright future. There may be a future of some sort. But.
Anything else?
Well, thank you.
Anything else? Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Here we go.
And you'll get back to us on those other issues.